Hello and welcome to the first hour of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, February 15th, 2026. This is Carrie, your volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. We'll begin this first hour with a feature front page article from the Republic on California condors. Then we'll move on to top stories about ICE, then on to Valley and State news, and conclude the first hour with news from USA Today. Our feature front page article is entitled Cliff Jumpers. The subtitle is Condors Soar Over the Grand Canyon, Kept Aloft with Help from Biologists, Despite the Threat of Poisoning from Lead Ammunition. This is by Brandon Loomis. A six-year-old California condor hopped from an open crate and trotted a half dozen steps toward the cliff, spreading its two-tone wings in the winter sun before launching over the upper end of Grand Canyon. Condor number 987's return to the wild after about 2 weeks in captivity provided a splendid vision of recovery for North America's largest land bird. But his swift glide up the side canyon along Badger Creek was made possible only by the abiding hand of humans. Biologists capture and treat the endangered species, which scavenge elk and deer carcasses for a living, only to court death by ingesting lead fragments that some hunters leave behind. This January's round of treatments was his second in as many years, and it had bought number 987 another chance to roam northern Arizona and southern Utah and, with luck, find a mate as he enters his breeding prime. His release was the latest in a long line of successful interventions without which, his caretakers say, a wild population of the scavengers with a 9.5-foot wingspans would not be sustainable. If he can steer clear of lead, number 987 has a chance to live for another 50 or 60 years. That's a lot of chances to breed if he finds a mate for life, even if condor pairs at best raise one chick every 2 years. This is management in action, said Tom Hawk, who leads the condor program for the nonprofit Peregrine Fund. Without it, wild condors could plunge rather than soar. Hawk's staff has federal authorization to trap and treat a species that numbered fewer than two dozen surviving members as recently as the early 1980s, and had to be taken into captivity for breeding and eventual reintroduction to the wild. Since releases began in the mid-1990s, the species has rebounded to more than 500 individuals, with more of them living now in distinct wild populations along the West Coast and the Inland Southwest than in captivity. Hawk's crew ministers to the inland flock. Lead is by far the largest killer of wild condors, Hawk said, accounting for nearly half of all diagnosed deaths. And his team is able to diagnose most of the deaths because they track them so closely, using both radio and GPS transmitters to help notify of a bird's whereabouts and alert them to any stoppage in their movements. Lead, he said, is really the limiting factor for recovery at this point. A wave of bird flu also took a heavy toll in 2023 before abating. The condor population in Arizona and Utah went into that year numbering 117, but lost 21 to flu and another 13 to lead, Hawk said. Why some hunters are willing to stop using lead ammo. Biologists of decades past knew lead was a problem that reintroduced birds could face once back in the wild, but not with such devastating results. The severity became apparent when they started dropping dead several years after release. Now biologists lay out dead calves at northern Arizona's Vermilion Cliffs National Monument to condition condors to come in for easy and clean meals in the months following the fall hunt. The attraction makes them easy to trap and test. Hawk's team traps around 85% of the southwestern flock each year, he said, and at least a third generally need treatment. Lead gets on the landscape primarily through fragments of ammunition, which are ingested when a condor tucks into a carcass or gut pile left on the ground. Arizona game officials have offered free or discounted copper-based bullets for hunters stalking prey on the Kaibab Plateau, where the birds spend part of their year, and have asked those using lead to drop off animal remains at checkpoints for disposal. More than 8 in 10 hunters oblige, according to the state, but it still leaves deadly levels of the toxin in condor range. Utah is now encouraging hunters to reduce lead pollution as well as the condors expand northward. Their routine territory now stretches as far as Panguitch Lake, northwest of Bryce Canyon National Park. While California has banned lead ammunition for hunting in that state, Arizona and Utah have sought voluntary aid for the birds. Conservation groups, including the Center for Biological Diversity, sued to force the U.S. Forest Service to restrict lead ammo from the Kaibab, but a federal court dismissed that case on appeal in 2023. Regardless, the Peregrine Fund prefers the voluntary approach, not least because many hunters in the region feel their gun rights and hunting privileges are under attack. We run into skepticism everywhere, including from my own family, because I'm a lifelong hunter, said Chris Parrish, the Peregrine Fund's president and a co-founder of the North American Lead-Free Partnership, which seeks to enlist hunters across the country to the cause because lead affects eagles and other animals as well. Backlash to strict regulation could jeopardize compliance as well as goodwill among ranchers who alert the program when clean meat is available or when birds appear to be at risk from game carcasses. In a worst case, it could cause people to actively target condors, as may have happened in some of the 11 known shootings since reintroduction. A few shootings appear to have been by hunters mistaking the birds for wild turkeys and self-reporting their mistakes. In any case, Parris said, California's ban hasn't kept condors from finding and ingesting lead there. Half my job is babysitting. Several field biologists for the Peregrine Fund live in cabins in Marble Canyon beneath the Vermilion Cliffs, so they can trap most members of the Southwest 96 California condors annually after hunting season. They draw them to a clifftop pen, about a 90-minute drive away on mostly bumpy two tracks, by setting out stillborn calves donated from Phoenix area dairies, then close the gate so they can net and hold each individual for a blood draw. If the lead level's too high, they transport the birds back to their treatment building on the valley floor, where they inject them twice daily for 5 days with a compound that binds to the lead and helps remove it from circulation. Without this treatment, a buildup of lead will essentially paralyze a bird's digestive tract to prevent swallowing, leaving food to stick and rot in their crop rather than nourishing them. Even with treatment, some won't make it. It could be that repeated high exposures wear on the organs or otherwise sap vitality even after blood levels reach normal, though the biologists say it would take more research to know for sure. The biologists are also responsible for delivering calf carcasses to the holding pens where condors await testing and treatment, and sometimes for gathering lead-contaminated deer carcasses from the land for disposal when they noticed that sickened birds had congregated at those sites. Half my job is babysitting, biologist Brianna Bode said after removing a picked-over carcass from the pen at the Marble Canyon Field Hospital. The other half is dragging around dead things. They also frequently wash regurgitated food, gurge as they call it, from their arms after cradling a condor's body in one arm and holding its mouth shut with the other during blood draws and injections. On rare occasions, the condor may bite, inflicting gashes in human skin from a beak that can just as easily shear cowhide. Despite all that, it's a dream job. I love condors, field biologist Kirsten Fuller said. I love getting to work with such a critically endangered species. She spent 6 years tracking them for Grand Canyon National Park before joining the Peregrine Fund team last year. The change allows her a hands-on role in keeping the birds alive and thriving in the Southwest rather than just monitoring them. They're very entertaining to watch, Fuller said. They're very curious. so different from some of the other species. Crew members also discern individual personalities, they say. Holding one condor's beak firmly so colleague Emma Haydenberg could draw his blood, Fuller noted that he was a known finger hazard. "Some birds don't try to bite," she said. "He tries to bite." "He's got ill intent," Haydenberg agreed. Another gave grandpa vibes, while a third, in her 20s, the oldest lady in the Southwest population and a frequent visitor to the trap site to gather meat for her offspring, was a sweetie. Condors play an important role in the ecosystem. The biologist tested the blood of 8 condors at the trap site that day, and all showed satisfactory lead results. It meant the crew could open the pen and lead them soar out from the snow-covered Vermilion Cliffs. "That's huge news," Haydenberg said. "This is a good day," Hawk said. "It's what the biologists hope to see when every January moves along. The threat from newfound contaminated deer carcasses and gut piles diminishes over the weeks and months after the fall hunting season ends." As a population, condors can play an important role along the smaller vulture species in effectively disinfecting ecosystems. Their iron stomachs protect them from numerous diseases that infected carcasses might transmit to lesser scavengers, including rabies. It's a lesson India learned in the 1990s when the introduction of an anti-inflammatory drug for livestock proved fatal to vultures that subsequently ate livestock carcasses. A near total collapse of some vulture species is estimated to have led to thousands of premature human deaths from resulting diseases left on the landscape. Among them is rabies, a risk that rose alongside a feral dog population that boomed on the carrion that the vultures no longer swept away. The Peregrine Fund spends about $1 million a year to manage and treat the Southwest California condors, Hawk said. That includes captive breeding at its headquarters in Boise, Idaho, which augments the wild-hatched populations. In the last year, he said, the organization lost about a third of its funds from canceled grants, money it will have to make up through increased fundraising. "We just have to work harder," he said. The Tucson-based Center for Biological Diversity was unable to convince a federal judge or appeals court to force the U.S. Forest Service to ban lead ammo on the KBAB to protect condors. The group argued that the agency has a responsibility to keep hazardous waste from the land, but courts found that the Forest Service leaves hunting regulations to the states. Even so, the organization believes Arizona should ban lead in condor range, because even the small minority of hunters leaving lead fragments there continued to stress the population. Lead ammunition is the single biggest obstacle to the recovery of the California condor, the center's environmental health legal director, Jonathan Evans, said in an email. Just one lead bullet in one KBAB mule deer carcass can poison multiple condors. Phasing out lead ammunition and requiring non-lead substitutes can stop the often slow, painful poisoning deaths of these iconic birds. Voluntary efforts help, but they're not enough. If we're serious about fully recovering the California condor, we must entirely phase out lead bullets. Spent lead ammo harms dozens of other species, including bald and golden eagles, he said, and also poses a risk to families of hunters who consume the game meat. Parrish of the Lead-Free Partnership rejects that view. "Better to inspire hunters to help than to scold and control them," he said. "Hunters and anglers do feel like a minority," he said, "and they are by the numbers." He has found it easier to sway them through cooperation, which takes time. When he first started making presentation about the merits of lead-free bullets at Phoenix Sporting Expos, he said people told him not to bring this crap here. Now, years later, he's more likely to hear how they're already participating. On a good wind day, they can jet. It's an old story, he said, and one that starts with waterfowl hunters more than a century ago. They agreed to a nationwide ban on lead shot for duck and goose hunting, but only after pressing the case themselves as a conservation priority. He also noted that hunters fund wildlife conservation through taxes on their purchase of gear, including ammo, another measure that hunting groups backed. Most KBAB hunters, 84%, take steps to reduce lead exposure, according to Aaron Brown, Lead Reduction Program Coordinator for the Arizona Department of Game and Fish in that region. Of those, more than half use lead-free bullets. Others either retrieve the carcass remains for disposal or aim for shots that minimize lead left in the flesh. In the pertinent zone of southwestern Utah, about 3/4 of hunters have voluntarily used lead-free ammo over the last 5 years, according to Utah Division of Wildlife Resources conservation biologist Danielle Finlayson. That's a big help to condors, but not yet enough to secure their place in the wild. It's a start, Parrish said. We have to reach more hunters and more shooters. For the condors that still find and suffer from lead fragments, a single 5-day treatment regimen isn't always enough. It wasn't for number 987, whose blood levels were elevated enough to require 2 rounds before his release at Badger Point atop the Grand Canyon. In especially persistent cases in which a fragment remains lodged in the digestive system, the crew may feed the bird calf fur to help expel it in a wad that looks like an owl pellet. Condors are social birds, and number 987 is likely to hang around northern Arizona near dozens of the others through winter before he and many of them head north into Utah for summer. All the birds spend time in all the places, Bode said. Some just roam more frequently. When they catch a strong tailwind, they can zoom hundreds of miles in a day. The team has tracked some that leave Arizona to gather food in the northern Kolob section of Utah's Zion National Park and return to feed a chick, a round trip of a few hundred miles all in the same day. A bird can leave here and be in Zion Park in less than 3 hours, Bode said. On a good wind day, they can jet. A couple of the males prefer Grand Canyon South Rim, and many frequent the trusses under Mibor Canyon's Navajo Bridge, where tourists can marvel at them. With continued help from conservation biologists and from hunters, this bird that was on the brink not so long ago will continue to spread its wings throughout the Southwest Canyon country. And that article was entitled Cliff Jumpers, and that was by Brandon Loomis. Now, our top article on ICE is entitled Phoenix Plan for ICE Prompts Rowdy Protest. This is by Sean Raimondo and David Uoa Jr. Phoenix is drafting a plan that city leaders believe will protect residents' civil rights when facing immigration and customs enforcement crackdowns. Local activists and immigrant advocacy groups, however, don't believe the city's proposed policy goes far enough to counter increased ICE operations, which have turned violent and at times deadly, disrupting communities across mostly Democratic U.S. cities. Amid a barrage of heckling and anti-ICE chants from protesters on February 10th, council members directed city staff to work on a policy called the Community Transparency Initiative and bring it back for consideration within 45 days. The proposed initiative aims to document any alleged civil rights violations and crimes by ICE officers, as well as track financial and other impacts on city services resulting from the Trump administration's immigration crackdown. City staff will also provide the council with options to address whether ICE can use public parks and Phoenix-owned property for staging operations. Communities like Tucson and Los Angeles have taken steps to keep ICE off of city-owned property. The directives come as ICE signaled plans to ramp up enforcement in Metro Phoenix. Last month, federal agents raided more than a dozen Zips Sports Grill locations. The ordeal prompted tense standoffs and clashes between masked agents and protesters outside some Zips locations, including in Midtown Phoenix, and shocked the local restaurant industry. And the Department of Homeland Security also bought a 418,400-square-foot warehouse in Surprise for over $70 million. ICE confirmed that it would be converted into a processing facility with about 1,500 beds, sparking a wave of outcry. Those local instances capped off an already turbulent month for the nation that was still reeling from the fatal shootings of Renee Good and Alex Preddy, both U.S. citizens, during immigration enforcement activities in Minneapolis. Across Phoenix, fear is changing behavior, Councilmember Betty Guardado said during this week's rowdy meeting. People are afraid to report crimes. Parents are afraid to take their children to school events. Workers are afraid to seek help when they are injured or exploited. Organizations like POTR in Action, Organized Power in Numbers, and 50501 have long advocated for migrant communities and workers. However, group members called Phoenix's proposed directives vague, arguing that the policy won't keep residents and immigrants safe from the violent attacks that have been reported in cities like Los Angeles, Chicago, and Portland. None of it is proactive, said POTR spokesperson Mike Cassidy, adding, "We see how ICE officers are behaving around the country." Anti-ICE protesters demand transparency from Phoenix. While the community groups were largely opposed to the policy over what they believe is ineffectual language, activists crowded the council meeting to chastise elected leaders for not allowing public input. Mayor Kate Gallego called on the council to meet for a work-study session to discuss the directives and decide whether city staff should proceed with drafting an ordinance. Though work-study meetings are still open for people to attend or watch online, it's a less formal session meant to allow council members to review and discuss ideas. As a result, public comments are usually limited or withheld until an ordinance is considered at a formal meeting. An hour before the city's meeting, a crowd of about 50 protesters gathered outside the council chambers with a bullhorn, trombone, tuba, trumpet, and a cowbell, demanding that the council let them voice their opinion on the Community Transparency Initiative. The initiative included five key components: document civil rights violations by ICE, track impacts on city services, partner with groups to aid the initiative, ensure the city can communicate with communities using multiple languages, train city employees on encountering federal enforcement. Citing the Zips raids and the Surprise detention facility, the protesters deemed the policy as weak and demanded five other directives: pay for deportation defense attorneys, ban ICE from using city-owned property, prohibit the suppression of protests, stop assisting deportation efforts, end collaboration with corporations that profit from ICE. The city has the power to actually prevent what we saw then and take action to have businesses and employees actually knowing their rights, to know what to put forth if an attack by ICE is coming, said Andrea Luna Cervantes, campaign manager for Organized Power. Protesters put black duct tape over their mouths to symbolize being silenced by the city council, according to Yamileth Montoya, a protester from West Phoenix with POTR in Action. Montoya had her mouth duct taped during the protests. The crowd grew and eventually filled the entire viewing area and the council chambers. They stayed silent during the beginning of the session and during part of the presentation on the initiative. Then, four protesters sprang from their seats to yell at Gallego and the council for not letting them speak. The group of four was joined by the entire crowd of protesters, who banged their chairs and led anti-ICE chants. They also berated the council for not listening to their communities. Councilmember Deborah Stark demanded order in the chambers and directed the crowd to stop yelling. The crowd did not stop. Gallego called a 10-minute recess about 10 minutes into the yelling. Demonstrators create confusion on Phoenix Council vote. When the meeting resumed, Councilmember Guardado made the motion to have staff develop the initiative and include language to address ICE's use of city-owned property. The crowd, however, continued to chant so loudly that it nearly drowned out the council's 7-2 vote and created some confusion on the Diaz. Councilmember Jim Waring was the only one officially opposed to proceeding with the policy, but amid the uproar, Councilmember Laura Pastor was also logged as giving a nay vote. "I was asking for clarity," Pastor explained to the Arizona Republic on February 11th. "I couldn't hear anything." She added that she supports the initiative. As for Waring, he said he doesn't believe the policy will do anything that isn't already being done. Speaking to the Republic after the meeting, he also expressed concern that the initiative would encourage people to document and record ICE activity on the city's behalf. "Who's liable for that?" Waring asked, without explaining. The Trump administration has often labeled people using cell phones to record ICE activities as agitators, leading to violent encounters. Asked whether his vote this week signals how he'll vote on the final draft of the policy in the coming weeks, Waring said he'll listen to city staff's presentation, but would be surprised if they come back with something that materially changes how Phoenix police interact with federal agents. After the vote, Vice Mayor Kesha Washington and Council Members Anna Hernandez and Pastor stayed behind as the protesters created a makeshift line so each could take turns yelling at the officials. "I don't want to see ICE ramp up here," Montoya of Poter said. "I don't want my neighbors to be affected. I don't want to be effective. Anyone that I know about, even people that I don't know, like no one should be in fear of this right now." And that article is entitled, "Phoenix Plan for ICE Prompts Rowdy Protest." That was by Sean Raimondo and David Uoa Jr. Now, another article on ICE, which you can listen to completely on the Gaggle podcast. This article is entitled, "Pro-ICE Advocate Warns Protesters About Guns at Rallies." This is by Amanda Luberto. Twice in January 2026, a U.S. citizen was shot and killed by federal agents during a surge in immigration enforcement in Minneapolis. The second victim, Alex Preddy, legally had a firearm when agents confronted him, adding a new layer to the national conversation regarding the methods used to carry out President Donald Trump's crackdown on illegal immigration. The raids, protests, and the new dimension of Second Amendment rights has gotten the attention of Arizonans as the presence of national agents has increased in the state. On January 26, 2026, Homeland Security officials conducted raids across 15 locations of Zips Sports Grills in Metro Phoenix. That sweep drew instant protest, including at least one person carrying out what appeared to be an assault rifle. On this episode of The Gaggle, a politics podcast by the Arizona Republic and azcentral.com, hosts Ron Hansen and Stephanie Murray talk with guests on both sides of the issue. First, a conversation with Erica Connell, an organizer for the Arizona chapter of 50501, a nationwide network of activists opposed to the Trump administration. Then we're joined by Art Del Cueto, an advisor to the Federation for American Immigration Reform, an organization that advocates for cutting legal and illegal immigration. And that article is entitled, "Pro-ICE Advocate Warns Protesters About Guns at Rallies." That was by Amanda Luberto. And you can listen to this on The Gaggle, a politics podcast by the Arizona Republic and azcentral.com. We're approximately 30 minutes past the hour in this first hour of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, February 15th, 2026. We're going to move on to Valley and State News with this article entitled, "DNA Leads to Arrest of a Suspect in 2024 Maryvale Homicide." This is by Ray Stern. Months went by after Roseanne Salaya's brother, Mark Anthony Montano, was found dead next to a trash container in Maryvale, and she worried the killer would never be caught. She hasn't slept since she got the news from a Phoenix homicide detective that a suspect was arrested. Raymond Drinkhouse, 44, was booked into jail February 10th on suspicion of second-degree murder after an extensive and robust investigation, Sergeant Rob Scherer, Phoenix police spokesperson, said in a statement to media outlets about the case. Salaya, who lives in Phoenix, told the Arizona Republic that she and other family members attended Drinkhouse's first court appearance at 2 a.m. February 11th, saying the arrest has been a great relief following her brother's gruesome death. "Nobody deserved this in any way for any reason," she said. "It does bring some good news to our family because of him getting caught." Officers found Montana's body with signs of trauma at about 9:23 a.m. on November 12, 2024, near apartment trash containers at a complex near 55th and Clarendon Avenues. He was strangled and his T-shirt stained with Drinkhouse's semen, according to a booking sheet. DNA test leads to suspect. Montano was found lying on a couch next to the trash containers, an orange safety vest wrapped around his neck and throat. A plastic bag was found in his mouth by a medical examiner during an autopsy, who listed the manner of death as asphyxiation in the setting of strangulation and airway obstruction, the record states. A DNA test on the semen on Montano's shirt resulted in a hit for Drinkhouse, who police discovered was in the Maricopa County Jail on unrelated charges. Online court records show he was charged in Glendale Municipal Court with possession of drug paraphernalia in January. During an interview with police, Drinkhouse denied knowing Montano or having issues with anyone, the booking sheet states. Asked why his DNA would be on Montano's shirt, Drinkhouse replied that he had never seen the shirt and didn't ejaculate on it, using a common slur for the act. The investigation found Drinkhouse's DNA on the orange vest and another plastic bag at the scene from the same store as the bag found in the victim's mouth. Victim had big heart. At 38, Montano was a divorced father of three children, the oldest being 19, and he struggled with substance abuse, Salaya said. "He wasn't a perfect guy, but he had a big heart," she said, adding that he helped people on the street and was trying to get off drugs. "We always kept in touch." "The family doesn't know Drinkhouse, nor what could have motivated him to hurt Montano," she said. Online court records show Drinkhouse has been convicted of several drug violations over the years and was incarcerated from 2005 to 2008 after conviction for attempted fraud. "This guy is denying everything," Salaya said. Her brother's body had defensive wounds, she said, indicating he tried to fight off his attacker. She also said she believes another suspect was involved. "My gut tells me there was more than one person who held him down so this could happen to him," Salaya said. "I hope the whole truth comes out." And that article is entitled "DNA Leads to Arrest of a Suspect in 2024 Maryvale Homicide." That was by Ray Stern. Our next article is entitled "PV Superintendent Fired for Untruthful Info on Application." This is by Alexandra Hartle. The Paradise Valley School Board voted to terminate the contract of a former superintendent placed on administrative leave after his previous district found that he may have been involved in artificially inflating grades. Todd Cummings started as superintendent of Paradise Valley Unified School District in July. At the end of September, the school board voted to place him on administrative leave without publicly disclosing why. According to the South Bend Tribune, Cummings was placed on administrative leave from the South Bend Community School Corporation and agreed to formally resign from the district at the end of the 2024-25 school year. The Paradise Valley Board voted unanimously at a December 2nd special meeting to move forward with terminating Cummings, who requested a hearing to appeal the decision. On February 10th, the board officially voted to terminate him. Cummings and his representatives were not present at the hearing. He could not be reached for comment. Susan Siegel, an attorney representing the district, said at the meeting that Cummings was untruthful on his job application. During the closed hearing, Siegel said that Cummings did not testify on his own behalf. He also did not allow the attorney who represented him in South Bend when he was negotiating his buyout contract to testify, Siegel said. On his job application, Siegel said Cummings was asked if he had ever been bought out of a contract or placed on administrative leave. Cummings said that he hadn't and that he had recently retired. He also said that he was utilizing his accrued days to get to the end of his contract in South Bend. Cummings was actually allowed to take his accrued days and be paid out of his contract. He negotiated a $225,000 contract buyout for the 2025-26 school year, despite representing the 2024-25 school year as the last year of his contract, Siegel said. It was designed completely to mislead the board and anybody else who read it, Siegel said. Several hours before the meeting, Siegel said Cummings' attorney in South Bend submitted a testimony that it wasn't a buyout agreement. But the hearing officer didn't believe it because of the evidence that was presented, Siegel said. And after Cummings started work at the district, Siegel said that he initiated a practice and pattern of incompetence, of disrespect, disregard, rudeness, being just generally difficult to work with, and being counterproductive to what the district's mission was. A subsequent investigation with a law firm found that to be supported by many witnesses, Siegel said. Siegel said that Cummings claimed that his due process rights were violated. But Siegel refuted that, noting he was paid his full salary and benefits when he was on administrative leave. Siegel added that Cummings was given notice and was allowed to prepare documents and cross-examine witnesses for the hearing. Simply because he disagrees with this does not mean that he was deprived of due process, Siegel said. Siegel informed the board that a lawsuit could come in the future, but that the process was followed by the book. And that article is entitled PV Superintendent Fired for Untruthful Info on Application. That was by Alexandra Hartle. Our next article is entitled Transit Change Won't Derail Site's Redevelopment. This is by Corinna Vanek. Phoenix plans to move ahead with redeveloping the intersection of 7th Avenue and Washington Street, despite abandoning efforts to extend the light rail there. The Phoenix City Council voted in January to scrap plans to extend the light rail service west to the Capitol, a voter-approved project called the CapEx. Instead, the council opted to prioritize service to the Maryvale neighborhood via a 10-mile extension along Indian School Road. The move throws a wrench into planning the redevelopment of the Capitol Mall between downtown and the state capitol, where city planners envision transit-oriented development projects around light rail service. Such developments cluster dense housing and walkable retail around transit stops. The goal is to capitalize on higher populations, providing more demand and revenue for transit, and the transit enables a range of people to work and shop without needing cars or the space to park them. The city owns land on all four sides of the intersection of 7th Avenue and Washington Street, including the Phoenix Police Department headquarters building. In 2025, the city completed a rezoning on the site that would allow redevelopment of three corners of the intersection. The police department is in the process of moving to the former Wells Fargo Tower. The rezoning allows buildings as tall as 250 feet and residential density up to 218 units per acre on the sites. At the time, it was pitched as a way to increase high-density development along light rail routes, city staff who worked in transit-oriented development said in late 2024. The site would have included a light rail station, which would have closed off 8th Avenue and created a pedestrian plaza through the property. At a meeting attended by leaders in the real estate industry and neighborhood advocates hosted in early 2025, consultants hired by the city discussed the long-range vision for Washington and Jefferson Streets between downtown and the state capitol. The meeting emphasized the importance of making the area more vibrant and inviting to the public as light rail developed in the area. At the time, Jay Hicks, principal at Diggs Studio, who has been working with the city on planning around the corridor, said the city's redevelopment of the intersection would be the gateway between downtown and the Capitol Corridor. Ashley Harder, a developer who was involved in the planning meeting for the 7th Avenue redevelopment and is now running for Phoenix City Council, said the removal of light rail does not affect the possibilities for the redevelopment, but does harm the overall connectivity in the area. Not having that connection will impact the success of the project, but it won't impact what can get built there, Harder said. The city has not yet released a request for proposals for redeveloping the property, but a spokesperson said the city will still seek similar development as what was envisioned with the light rail. The Phoenix City Council's vote to reevaluate high-capacity transit options for West Phoenix does not significantly impact the ongoing efforts around the 7th Avenue and Washington Request for Proposals process, Athena Sanchez, spokesperson for the city, said in an email. Sanchez said all projects in the central city area are planned to encourage multimodal transportation and activity, like shops and restaurants on the ground floor. The rezoning of the sites, even though it was planned to incorporate transit, allows those uses. We have already completed the rezoning of the city-owned parcels, and at this time, no additional changes are expected. The capital expansion has been in the planning and development phase for more than 5 years, with public meetings, engagement, presentations, and engineering work taking place since 2020. The effort so far represents about $25 million worth of work. Most of the land along the Capitol Extension stretch is government-owned. Phoenix, Maricopa County, and Arizona all have significant land holdings along Washington and Jefferson Streets between 7th Avenue and the Capitol. The area was pitched years ago as a possible redevelopment target that would go alongside the light rail extension. Many state offices shrunk their footprints or consolidated spaces after the pandemic, leaving some buildings vacant or underutilized, teeing up possible redevelopment. Some buildings along the stretch have already been demolished. In a letter to the Phoenix City Council, Ben Henderson, director of the Governor's Office of Planning and Budget, said departing from the planned capital extension would forego an estimated $4 billion of economic impact every 10 years. Extending the light rail would prime the stretch for affordable housing, he said. The governmental mall includes numerous parcels owned by the state that are available for housing development now and are made much more economically feasible due to proximity to the light rail, he wrote. The governor's 2027 budget proposes selling 9 state-owned properties, totaling 11 acres in the stretch, Henderson wrote. Those and city-owned properties would increase in value with the capital extension, he said. In a time of housing crisis, state-owned parcels so near to the heart of our largest city should not lie vacant, and, in partnership with the City of Phoenix, we have the opportunity to spur their responsible and beneficial development for their highest and best use, Henderson wrote. And that article is entitled, Transit Change Won't Derail Sites Redevelopment. That was by Corinna Vanek. We're going to move on to national and world news with articles from USA Today. We've got 2 front page articles. The first is on Alexei Navalny, and the second is on Volodymyr Zelensky. The first article is entitled, European Allies Say Navalny Poisoned. The subtitle is, Site Dart Frog Toxin, Russia Rejects Claims. This is by Muvia M. 5 European countries on February 14th blamed Russia for killing late Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny using toxin from poisoned dart frogs while he was held in an Arctic penal colony 2 years ago, a claim Moscow rejected as propaganda. In a joint statement, Britain, France, Germany, Sweden, and the Netherlands said analyses of samples from Navalny's body conclusively confirmed the presence of epibatidine, a toxin found in poisoned dart frogs in South America and not found naturally in Russia. The Russian government, which has repeatedly denied any responsibility for Navalny's death, dismissed the latest allegations as a Western propaganda hoax, according to Russian state news agency TASS, while the Russian embassy in London said, "One must ask what kind of person would believe this nonsense about a frog." Britain, on February 14th, said the poisoning demonstrated an alarming pattern of behavior. The country held a public inquiry into the poisoning in Britain of Russian double agent Sergei Skripal in 2018. It concluded last year that Russian President Vladimir Putin must have ordered the Novichok nerve agent attack. When the test results are available and the formulas for the substances are disclosed, we will comment accordingly, Russian Foreign Ministry spokesperson Maria Zakharova was quoted as saying by TASS. Until then, all such assertions are merely propaganda aimed at diverting attention from pressing Western issues, the news agency cited her as saying. The report also said she described Navalny as a blogger officially designated as a terrorist and extremist in Russia. The Britain government declined to comment to a Reuters query about how the samples from Navalny's body were obtained or where they were assessed. Foreign Minister Yvette Cooper told reporters that UK scientists worked with our European partners to pursue the truth on Navalny's death. Russian opposition leader Navalny died in an Arctic prison colony in February 2024 after being convicted of extremism and other charges, all of which he denied. His death was announced minutes before the opening of the Munich Security Conference in 2024. In response, the conference made a rare schedule adjustment to allow his widow, Yulia Navalnaya, to address the conference, and she called for Putin to be held accountable. "I was certain from the first day that my husband had been poisoned, but now there is proof. I am grateful to the European states for the meticulous work they carried out over 2 years and for uncovering the truth," she said on social media while attending this year's Munich conference on February 14th. The Russian embassy spokesperson said the European allies' move was not a quest for justice, but a mockery of the dead. Even after the death of the Russian citizen, London and the European capitals cannot allow him to rest in peace, a fact that speaks volumes about those who instigated this campaign, the spokesperson added. The February 14th statement from the European allies, almost exactly 2 years after Navalny's death, said Moscow had the means, motive, and opportunity to administer the poison as Navalny died in prison. Russia claimed that Navalny died of natural causes. But given the toxicity of epibatidine and reported symptoms, poisoning was highly likely the cause of his death, the joint statement said. His death was followed by memorial gatherings and protests across Europe, with demonstrators in cities including London, Berlin, Rome, and Vilnius, Lithuania, condemning the Kremlin. And that article is entitled, "European Allies Say Navalny Poisoned." That was by Muvia M. Our next front-page article from USA Today is entitled, "Zelensky, U.S. Too Often Asks Concessions of Kyiv." The subtitle is, "Says Onus is Being Placed on Ukraine, Not Russia." This is by Max Hunder. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky voiced hope on February 14th that U.S. brokered peace talks in Geneva in the coming days would be substantive. But he said Ukraine was being asked too often to make concessions. He also accused Moscow of seeking to delay decisions by changing its lead negotiator. Ukrainian, Russian, and American delegations are due to meet in the Swiss lakeside city on February 17th to the 18th as President Donald Trump seeks to push through a deal to end Europe's biggest war since 1945. "We truly hope that the trilateral meetings will be serious, substantive, helpful for all of us, but honestly, sometimes it feels like the sides are talking about completely different things," Zelensky said in a speech at the annual Munich Security Conference. Ukraine and Russia, which invaded its neighbor in February 2022, have engaged in two recent rounds of talks brokered by Washington in Abu Dhabi, described by the sides as constructive but achieving no major breakthroughs. Zelensky called for greater action from Ukraine's allies to press Russia into making peace, both in the form of tougher sanctions and more weapons supplies. Recalling his appeal 4 years ago, when he spoke at the same conference days before tens of thousands of Russian troops poured into Ukraine, Zelensky said there was too much talk by Western officials and not enough action. Trump has the power to force Putin to declare a ceasefire and needed to do so, Zelensky said. Ukrainian officials have said a ceasefire is required to hold a referendum on any peace deal, which would be organized alongside national elections. The Ukrainian leader, a former television entertainer, acknowledged he was feeling a little bit of pressure from Trump, who on February 13th said Zelensky should not miss the opportunity to make peace soon and urged him to get moving. The Americans often return to the topic of concessions, and too often those concessions are discussed only in the context of Ukraine, not Russia, Zelensky said. Instead, Zelensky said he wanted to hear what compromises Moscow would be ready for, as Ukraine had already made many of its own. Russia said its delegation to Geneva would be led by Putin's advisor Vladimir Medinsky, a change from negotiations in Abu Dhabi, at which Russia's team was led by military intelligence officer Igor Kostyov. Zelensky told reporters on February 14th the change was a surprise for Ukraine and suggested to him that Russia wanted to delay any decisions from being agreed. Ukrainian officials have criticized Medinsky's handling of previous talks, accusing him of delivering history lessons to the Ukrainian team instead of engaging in constructive negotiations. Deadlock over territory. Land remains the major sticking point in negotiations, with Russia demanding that Ukraine cede the remaining 20% of the eastern region of Donetsk that Moscow had failed to capture, something Kyiv steadfastly refuses to do. At a news conference on February 14th, Zelensky said that U.S. negotiators had told Ukraine that the Russians had promised a swift end to the war if Ukrainian forces immediately withdrew from the part of the Donetsk it still controls. He said earlier he was instead ready to discuss a U.S. proposal for a free trade zone in that region, while freezing the rest of the 745-mile front line. Ukraine's chief negotiator, Rustem Umerov, who sat beside Zelensky during the media briefing, said the only two options were either that Ukraine sticks to the current lines of control or that a free economic zone is established. Russia occupies about 20% of Ukraine's national territory, including Crimea and parts of the eastern Donbas region seized before the full-scale invasion in 2022. Analysts say Moscow has gained about 1.5% of Ukrainian territory since early 2024. Its recent airstrikes on Ukraine's cities and electricity infrastructure have left hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians without heating and power during the course of a bitterly cold winter. Ukrainian officials have repeatedly expressed concern in recent weeks that U.S. congressional midterm elections in November could focus the Trump administration on domestic political issues after the summer. Zelensky said he hoped the United States would stay involved in the negotiations and that there would be an opportunity for Europe, which he said was currently sidelined, to play a bigger role. Europe is practically not present at the table. It's a big mistake, to my mind, he said. Zelensky also suggested Moscow was opposed to the deployment of French and British troops in Ukraine after the war because Russian President Vladimir Putin wants to have the opportunity to come back. And that article is entitled Zelensky, U.S. Too Often Asks Concessions of Kyiv. That was by Max Hunder. Now, in our news and briefs section of the paper, this article is entitled Mistrial Declared Over Students Charged After Stanford Protests. A judge declared a mistrial February 13th in the case of five current and former Stanford University students related to the 2024 pro-Palestinian protests when demonstrators barricaded themselves inside the school president's office. 12 protesters were initially charged last year with felony vandalism, according to prosecutors who said at least one suspect entered the building by breaking a window. Police arrested 13 people on June 5, 2024, in relation to the incident, and the university said the building underwent extensive damage. The case was tried in Santa Clara County Superior Court against five defendants charged with felony vandalism and felony conspiracy to trespass. The rest previously accepted plea deals or diversion programs. Jurors failed to reach a verdict after deliberations. The charges were among the most serious against participants in the 2024 protest movement at U.S. colleges, in which demonstrators demanded an end to Israel's war in Gaza and Washington's support for its ally. The next one is entitled Opposition Group. Venezuela has freed 17 more political prisoners. Venezuela, on February 14th, freed 17 political prisoners, the Human Rights Committee of Opposition Movement Vente Venezuela said in a post on X. Clip V, a non-government organization, separately reported the release of the political prisoners, who included 10 men and 7 women from the Zona 7 prison in Caracas. Relatives outside the prison joined a hunger strike initiated by prisoners after only 17 of more than 50 detainees were released, human rights groups said. Clip V said the protest is a demand for the government to fulfill a pledge made earlier this month by the head of Venezuela's National Assembly to grant liberty to everyone held at the center. Venezuela has been gradually releasing detainees following the January 3rd capture of President Nicolas Maduro by the United States. Rights group Foro Penal says it has verified more than 430 releases of prisoners since January 8th. And that is all the time that we have for this news and brief section from USA Today. And this concludes the first hour of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, February 15th, 2026. This has been Carrie, your volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. Now, if you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcastinfo and audio/on-demand. You can take Sun Sounds with you. You can get our stream and on demand on our new Sun Sounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. Now, please stay tuned for the second hour of the Arizona Republic.